Well, we find ourselves in the first book of the Bible, the first chapter of the Bible, which is foundational to the rest of the book. The book is foundational to the rest of the Bible, and verse 1 here is foundational to the rest of the chapter. And where does it begin? It begins with God. Now, admittedly, the word God is not the first word in the English or in the Hebrew Bible, but it is emphasized. What it really means is God, who before the beginning created the heavens and the earth. But for various different reasons, we have in our languages the order of words that really try to emphasize and reveal these things. Although the word God, or the name of God, is not the very first word in the Bible, the emphasis there is that God is first and foremost in all things. If you really want to delve in and really get the meaning of what is happening here, although it is only 10 words in the English language, 7 words in the Hebrew language, maybe the essence of it is that God in the beginning, or before the beginning, or God who was before the beginning, created time, heaven, space, and earth, matter. It begins with God. Although the name of God is not the very first word, that is where we always need to begin. When a child is born, when somebody we love is sick or dying or has passed away, when our prayers are answered or there are mysterious delays to our prayers, where do we begin? We begin with God. When the world rises up against us and our dreams are shattered, maybe, where do we turn? We begin with God. In the light of every providence, we need to stand back from absolutely everything again and again in our lives and respond first and foremost in seeking God. That's what Sunday's really all about, isn't it? The first day of the week, reminding us that God is first and foremost. And therefore, we come together to worship, to acknowledge, to read and hear his word, to put him first, to give him, well, as the New Testament puts it in the case of Jesus Christ, the eternal Son of God, the preeminence. Back of all, if you like, above all, before all, is the God of the book of Genesis. He is first in rank, first in station, first in power, before whom one man has said, we float like specks of dust in his eternal vision. The book of Genesis, there's an awful lot that is going to be said as we break it down. It would take us just about an hour or so to read it. It's going to take us hours and hours and hours Sunday by morning. And sometimes even some of the complex things that are not good for a Sunday morning may be dealt with on a Tuesday. And it is going to take us hours and hours and hours. And then we're going to get to the end and think, you know what, we've only really just began to scratch the surface. We could go back and revisit and enlarge upon many of the things that we have somewhat superficially just touched upon. All things exist by him and through him and for him, Paul tells us. The only one who is worthy to receive glory, honor, power, the book of Revelation reminds us. He has created all things, and for his honor and delight they were created. We're going to delve into who is God and what is God like through the book as we think about the origins, not just of time and of space and of matter as we have it in the introductory statement, but it goes on to describe that the origin of all things, of plants and of the stars and of the animals and of mankind, of the family and marriage, the origin of suffering and evil and pain and death, the origin of the family, the origin of culture, the origin of government, the origin of the Israelite people, the origin of God's grace and salvation and the promises are all here for us in the book of Genesis. The attributes of God that we see somewhat dimly here are elaborated and explained upon throughout the rest of the book. That God is eternal, that God is unchanging, that God is self-sufficient, that God is inescapable. As you are confronted with him once again, Sunday by Sunday, but particularly in this verse, you are confronted by a God who has no beginning, who is omnipotent, who is all-powerful. There is no limit to his eternal and infinite power. He is self-existent and eternal. He is not dependent upon anything or anyone. He is unchanging and eternally the same and inescapable. You can't ignore him. You can't pretend he doesn't exist. You can't close your ears and your heart to him because he is before all things. And as we're going to see this morning, and again throughout this series, there is no meaning to life. There is no value to life. There is no purpose or point to life. There is no dignity in life whatsoever unless it is grounded and in reference to the God of the Bible. He is self-existent because he was before the beginning. He is eternal and uncreated. He is omnipotent. He is sovereign. When we ask the question, why is there anything at all? Because God made and created it is the only rational, reasonable, and even scientific answer to that great question. And we will see again and again that he is inescapable. Well, we owe God every honor, don't we, in our power to give him. As one lawyer came to Jesus and could see that he was a teacher that was sent from God and was answering all these difficult questions that nobody else could answer, and he could see something, and nobody denied the miracles that Jesus was doing. They didn't say, oh, this is sleight of hand and these things never happened. They knew that they happened, and the only thing that they could do was say that they were done by the power of Beelzebub and by Satan himself. But one lawyer could see through and say, the evil one would never do such things. He would never show such compassion. He would never show such kindness and goodness. He would never be so benevolent. He would never be so compassionate and kind. And came to him and says, we know that you are a teacher sent from God. What is the foremost commandment? What is the foremost responsibility of mankind? As we are responsible and accountable and answerable to the inescapable God, what is first and foremost? And Jesus says that you would love him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And we see this, don't we, as you flip-flop, and we're going to be flip-flopping later on from Genesis to Revelation, because all of the things that are mentioned here, and all of these words, and all of these objects, and all of these concepts, and all of these ideas, and all of these things that we experience in life, they find their origin and beginning in Genesis, but they find their fulfillment and completion, if you like, in Revelation. And we will throughout the series be comparing somewhat of many of the things that are finding their completion. And mankind, in a sense, finds his completion at the end of time in worshipping, serving, loving, and obeying God. And well, we're at the beginning. And so let's begin at the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. With these words, the scriptures begin, profound and sublime words. And God is both the subject and the author of all that will follow. He is responsible for everything, both seen and unseen. And although in the English it's 10 words, like I say, in the Hebrew, just 7 words that to describe to us and help us grasp and understand all of the mysteries of the universe in which we live. Beginning would point us to time. God would create us to power and energy. The word create would remind us of information, if you like. The heavens is space and the earth is matter, and all of the mysteries of the universe are there bound up in the first 7 words of the Hebrew Bible. The sentence tells us this morning 4 things. Now, sometimes during these series, I'm going to be in more familiar territory. And for me, it's going to be a little bit easier, the preparation and the delivery, and I'm not going to need so many notes, and I'm not going to need to put my head down in my notes. At other times, though, there are things that I'm not so familiar with, and I'm going to need to put my head in my notes just for a few minutes or so. The sentence begins, doesn't he, reminding us that in the beginning, the uncreated God created. It was in the beginning that the uncreated God created. When everything else began, God was already there. Time and space and dimensions and matter all commenced, but God had no commencement. He was the unbegun one, the unoriginated one, the eternal self-existing one. Everything else of which we have had any of experience of had a beginning, but not him. There is nothing that exists that did not have its origin. All things can be traced back, well, to this very verse, to this truth. This is the ultimate explanation, isn't it, of the beginning of everything, of all creatures, great and small. They find their origin explained to us here in this verse. The Creator, however, is different from every other kind of being. He never began. There is nothing to which we really can compare him to, and that's why often we just fall down in worship, lost in wonder, love, and praise. In the beginning, he gave to everything else form, substance, structure, and life. So our world's history has a starting point, and in other words, the world's history is linear, moving forwards in a succession of events from one to the other, rather than in some kind of a circle. And what we're going to be doing is comparing again and again the biblical worldview of looking at the universe and the world and life and everything else compared to many of the other ways in which unbelievers around us look at the world. And they look at the world, it's just a cycle. It's just going round and round in a pointless, meaningless, devoid circle from one generation to another, from one millennia to another, from one implosion to another explosion and everything else. Whereas the Bible tells us very clearly, no, reality moves on in a linear fashion. Outside of time is the God who is timeless and eternal, who creates time, and the history of mankind moves on in a linear way, reminding us later on in the Bible that the God who created time, the God who is governing over time and everything else, will one day bring it all to an end. Reminding us again of that grand truth that we're going to go back to, that God is inescapable. We can't forget him, we can't ignore him, we can't say he doesn't exist. He is inescapable. We are accountable and responsible to him. The beginning of time and space and matter came about in this way, the Bible says. God created the heavens and the earth. Well, there it is. If a child asks, if God made us, who made God? And smiles and thinks to himself to be very smart. The answer is that God has no beginning or end of days. He is from eternity to eternity. He is the cause of all things, and yet nothing caused him to have his existence. He has no birthday. He has no external life support system, but is self-sufficient. You notice in Genesis 1 there is no family tree, no divine genealogy spelled out for us in the first chapter. Here he is. He is God. He is eternal. And God is solely responsible, secondly, for creating. There is nobody else. All of creation has its beginning with God, and God alone is the creator and the maker of all things. God invents it. The entire engineering of absolutely everything is his and his alone. The planning and the accomplishment of all things was with him and him alone. There was nothing and nobody else making any suggestions to him, let alone helping him. There was God alone purposing, designing, and finally firing the starting pistol, if you like, of all that comes into being. And you have the common name for God here, Elohim, which is a masculine plural of the form of the Hebrew word El, which means strength or might. Now we're going to be looking into that he is one God, but it is a plural masculine verb pointing us towards what we would call the Trinity,
that is finally and perfectly revealed throughout the rest of Scriptures. But he and he alone creates. And the word here for creates has three remarkable features. It means that he produces something new. Now, we can endeavor, can't we, to form things and fashion things and shape things and take pre-existent material and make art with it or various other things. But the word here is only used a few times, and what it really means is he just, from nothing, makes something that has never had its existence and is new. The word is used very sparingly, even in the book of Genesis, as God does create things, the heavens and the earth, and then he takes the things that he has created, forming and fashioning. We can form and fashion things that already exist, but God can create from nothing things that had no existence. That's what the word here creates. And God himself is the one creating. The word is never used for the actions and the abilities of mankind. Mankind cannot create. We can form, we can fashion, we can mold, we can shape, we can take pre-existent materials and add them together and do all manner of fascinating things. And we shall see that we are created in the image of God, and our abilities to do all of these kinds of things come to us from the God who made and created us, but we cannot create. It's an incommunicable attribute of God. God alone can take things, or well, not taking things, God alone can just bring into being things that had no existence previously. From nothing, he can make all things. As someone has said, that God, he steps out from behind the curtain of nowhere, he stands on the platform of nothing, and speaks the universe into existence. So the word create is never used with any reference to previous materials that are needed. We're told that God creates with such and such materials. Well, we're not told that he creates with such and such materials. The materials are irrelevant, and he comes and creates from nothing. So all things are created by the God who has no beginning. He and he alone is solely responsible for creating, and every single atom in the cosmos is created by him. There was nothing at all before Genesis 1:1 except God. Well, the anti-creationist view that is so prevalent, the materialism and the humanism that is so prevalent in our day and in our age, well, how on earth do they explain the universe? How do we explain all the protons and the neutrons and the atoms and the living cells and everything else and the complexity of the world in which we live? They either say, and it has been most commonly believed by ancient scientists and by some recent modern scientists, that it's all eternal. That there was this infinitesimal speck that they can't even begin to try and explain, and from that speck, everything existed within that speck, and everything that we have today has come out of that speck. Others have said, no, the universe is not eternal, but time and space and matter have their beginning in a huge explosion. Now, where the time came from for it to explode into, and how on earth all of the design and everything else has come of that, is a beyond a mystery to me and to many others as well. It's so much easier, isn't it? It's so much more likely, it's so much more probable that this is the reality and the explanation for all of the mysteries of the universe in which you and I live. That God is uncreated, and it was in the beginning that God created all things, and he alone is solely responsible for creating, and every single atom in the cosmos was created by God. We can't imagine nothingness, the absence of a millionth of a proton even, simply nothing whatsoever is beyond our ability to grasp. A proton is an infinitesimal part of an atom. A proton is so small that the dot on the top of an I in your Bible or in your hymn book would gather something like 500,000 million protons. 500,000 million protons just in a dot on the page. And imagine, therefore, how many billions upon billions upon billions upon billions, numbers that we can't even begin to fathom. How many protons, how many atoms, how many molecules are there in the universe in which we live? And you're trying to tell me that these things exploded out of nothing, that nothing created everything from nothing? Or you're trying to tell me that all of these things are eternal and have no being, when the law of cause and effect governs everything in the known universe? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The reason why we reject this, the psalmist and Paul and others tell us, is because we don't like it. Not because it doesn't seem probable, not because it's not scientifically provable, but because in our selfish, fallen state, we just don't like it, which we will look at in Genesis chapter 3 and later on again and again and again. But when you step back, are we talking about a load of mumbo jumbo week in and week out? No. It seems most probable, most likely, most obvious, and the easiest of all the religious or the world views to embrace, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The anti-creationist speaks of the eternal existence of a billionth of a proton, referring to it as a singularity, and says that in the beginning that singularity was all that there was, a billionth of a proton, if you like. There was no space, there was no darkness, there was no dimensions, there was no time, just this speck in the beginning. And then one day it exploded, so he claims, in a big bang that made the universe. And in that speck, I'm thinking about how there are 500,000 million or billion, sorry, protons in a speck on your page. And in that speck was Mozart and Hitler and Albert Einstein and Leonardo da Vinci and Shakespeare and Jesus. They were all there, and love and patience and forgiveness and hatred and everything else was in that infinitesimal speck. And the speck exploded. And within that speck was everything. And now here we are. Doesn't seem believable, does it? The Bible says that before the beginning, there was nothing whatsoever but God alone. And everything that man has discovered, and all that we know, and all that is yet unknown, was made by the act of a living, speaking God. No speck is eternal. No speck was in their beginning. And every speck there is was made by God. Today there is not a single speck, a single proton that can pipe up and claim, I at least was not made by God. The Lord God made them all. Fourthly, so we see that the uncreated eternal God created and made all things. He is responsible for creating all things, and every atom in the cosmos was created by this timeless and eternal good God. Fourthly then, before we have some closing applications, if you like, the world was the special focus of God's creation. This is what these opening words grammatically are emphasizing, that in the beginning God created the heavens and, if you like, especially the earth. Our Earth, considered in terms of size, is an average-sized planet encircling an average-sized star, isn't it? The Earth is dwarfed by four other planets in our solar system: Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Neptune is 318 times bigger than the Earth, but the Earth is the focus of God's attention, as we see in this verse, as you delve into the original language, and as you're going to see throughout the book of Genesis. That mankind, that this planet, the earth, is the emphasis of God's creation. When we consider our sun, which is part of our great galaxy, the Milky Way, well, Nobody knows how many stars there are in the Milky Way. The estimation is 60 to 400 billion. And the Hubble telescope so far has detected 80 billion other galaxies in the universe. So when the Bible tells us that there are stars of the sky as innumerable as the grains of sand on all the seashores on our planet, this was laughed at until relatively recently, but now is realized to be true. There are as many stars up there in this galaxy and the 800 other billion galaxies, in the universe. There are as many stars as grains of sand on the seashore. And yet, the earth is the special emphasis of God's creation. God's interest was focused on our world and its inhabitants, and the humans that we look here were made in his image. The rest of Genesis chapter 1 and the remainder of the Bible concentrates on this unique planet of ours, and as far as we know are the only living people in all of the whole universe. The only living life that we have any evidence of is on this planet. Scripture looks at the rest of the cosmos then as the backcloth to this earth and mankind on earth. It's called a geocentric or a earth-centered view of reality, and it is deplored by many in the Western world in our day and in our age. The Bible seems to be pointing very clearly in the first verse as you look at the grammar, but certainly as you go through, that with all of these billions upon billions of galaxies and billions upon billions upon billions of stars and everything else that is out there, it is this planet, which is very small even compared to other planets in our solar system, it is there where God's special favor is shown, where God's special attention is. You see, for many of us in our day and in our age, we're just a tiny, tiny, tiny little speck, aren't we? In a tiny, tiny little galaxy amongst billions and billions of other galaxies. And we're just a speck and we're totally insignificant. And the consequence is then that life is meaningless. Life has no purpose. Life has no dignity. And it gives rise, doesn't it, to communism and to the Third Reich and to abortion and all manner of other things. That we don't have any value. We can't have any value. We can't have any meaning. We can't have any dignity. We can't have any purpose without God. You can try all you like. And this is where when we turn around and we look at everybody else who is on the outside, who doesn't build his worldview upon biblical principles, many of them are saying, yeah, it is true. Our lives have no dignity, have no value, have no meaning, no purpose, no worth whatsoever. And many of them just commit suicide or advocate all manner of barbaric, cruel practices. But the Bible tells us that before the beginning there was God. God created and made all things alone. Everything that has its existence is because God has created and made it. And the world is the special focus of God's creation. Carl Sagan, a name that some of us might know, an American astronomer who readily opposed the Christian view of creation, was interviewed in 1990, a week before he died, and he had no idea that he was dying whatsoever. The interviewer asked him in closing remarks, any words of wisdom that you would like to share? We live on a hunk of rock, he says, and metal that circles a humdrum star that is one of 400 billion other stars that make up the Milky Way galaxy, which is one of billions of other galaxies which make up the universe, which may be one of a very large number, perhaps an infinite number of other universes. This is a perspective on human life and our culture that is well worth pondering, he says. These closing, despairing words are saying this, that we basically come from nowhere, we are going nowhere, there is no purpose in anything that we see around us, life is meaningless, and humans are not special in any sense of the word whatsoever. How different to Genesis 1:1, that there is a creator, that mankind has a maker, that God has designed the universe with this world particularly, this planet, us particularly at heart, that he especially made the earth amongst all the billions of stars in the cosmos, and humans are very special, made in his image. And our Maker is not silent, but speaks to us clearly through his Son, Jesus Christ. And when you believe that, then you have a very, very different outlook on life altogether. You say that the lives of men, women, and unborn children count in the sight of God, their Creator, and their Judge. So our world basically has been confronted by two opposing views. You are, many of you, caught up in a world with two opposing views. One is calling you one way, saying, isn't it obvious? Isn't it far more likely? Isn't it more probable that there is an eternal God who created time and all things are created by him, that earth is his special heart, if you like, and the emphasis of his creation? And that is one way to look at the world, and the other way to say no. We don't believe the Bible. We don't believe that there is an eternal creator. We believe that the universe is either eternal or spontaneously from seemingly nothing, it exploded and created and made all things. What is your explanation for mankind's incredible achievements? His heart, his mind, his ability to listen even this morning, to absorb this information and think about it. What is your explanation for mankind's self-sacrifice and creativity? What is your explanation of why the world is in the state that it is in? Well, to me, to vast amounts of others, Genesis seems to be the only probable, the only possible, and every other view is not only improbable, but even impossible. It is no wonder, therefore, that the New Testament and the rest of the Bible is fascinated with Genesis. It is no surprise whatsoever that Jesus Christ himself quotes multiple times from the book of Genesis, and quotes from every single one of the first 11 chapters, and quotes from all of the other different segments and sections of the book of Genesis. It is no wonder, therefore, that the psalmists and the prophets and the apostles and the other writers of the New Testament and the Old Testament are somewhat fascinated by the book of Genesis, obviously read it, memorized parts of it, and quote from it extensively. As this verse, this profound, sublime verse, it puts an end, doesn't it, to all atheism. That God was in the beginning. And they say, no, there was no God at the beginning. It denies all the polytheism of Hinduism with all of their thousands and many gods, that there is but one God alone. It refutes pantheism and the New Age movement that sees everything as being God and that matter is God. No, God is transcendent. He is outside and the creator and the maker of all things. It blows to pieces, doesn't it, the theory of dualism where there is two gods, one God and one evil, and they are at war with one another in the universe. These words challenge humanism because they enthrone God as the center of the universe rather than mankind. What seems most probable? What seems most likely? What seems even possible? As we somewhat just stop now and we step outside and we look at this verse, you may say, I can't believe that there is an eternal God who created and made all things. What are your other options? That there are two gods, one good and one evil, warring one with another in the universe. That there are thousands of gods. That everything is God. That the universe created itself from nothing, or the universe is eternal. It takes more faith to believe those other views
They are far less likely to be true. They are far less probable to be true. And in actual fact, when you do delve into it, as we shall do in coming weeks and months, they are impossible. And therefore, the only conclusion that we can make is that the mysteries of the universe in which me and you live is found here in this verse, in a self-existent, eternal, unchangeable, omnipotent God who sovereignly chose to create rather than not create, who is inescapable, to whom we must all give an account. We respond this morning as we come somewhat to a close to these truths. And let me just tell you three things as we close. We need to admire the handiwork of God, and we're going to be opening up as we go through Genesis 1 and 2 particularly and turning back to it. But when we think that God, the eternal, uncreated God, has made all things on his own without any help, that there is nothing that does not have its origin and beginning in God, and that God is the center of the universe in which we live, and the earth is the special apple of his eye, if you like. We should admire the handiwork of God who created and made all things. You see, so much of the scientific community today, they're there and they tell us, oh, God doesn't exist. But how did modern science really begin? Modern science really began, as we know it, at the Reformation, where people took this verse that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and they wanted to look into the handiwork of God that they could admire the Creator, not using their knowledge and their findings out, if you like, to even deny his existence. And that we should admire the handiwork of God. You can consider the fixed and exact distance of the earth from the sun. That if it was further away from the sun, this planet would be too cold. If the earth were closer to the sun, the planet would be too hot. And we are alive today because the distance from this planet to the sun is set exactly and does not change. The air that you are breathing at this moment is the exact, perfect, and correct mixture of gases. 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 93% argon, or 0.93% argon, 0.35 carbon dioxide, and 0.035 of other gases. If the atmosphere had 25% oxygen or more, spontaneous fires would break out all over the place. If the atmosphere had less than 15%, it would suffocate. If the atmosphere had more carbon dioxide, the earth would become too warm. If the atmosphere had less carbon dioxide, plants would starve. What's the probabilities of that then happening without a designer, creator, and sustainer of the universe in which we live in? Or again, consider the tilt of the Earth axis at 23.5 degrees, which gives us our moderate seasons. If the tilt was greater, for example, like some planets have a tilt of 98 degrees, the Earth would have periodic continental flooding and long, long periods of darkness. If the Earth's tilt was less, for example, planet like the planet Venus, which has no tilt at all, it would cause equatorial areas to grow much hotter, the ice caps to expand. Again, the proximity of the moon is exactly where it should be. If it were a fifth of the distance away, tides would completely submerge continents twice a day, and life as we know it could not exist. The thickness of the Earth's crust is absolutely perfect for life. If it was thicker or thinner, the oxygen content would either be too small or too great. The water vapor levels in the atmosphere are exactly what they need to be. The color of the sun is absolutely perfectly correct. The force of gravity is absolutely spot on right. The speed of light at 186,000 miles per second is absolutely perfect. And if it was much faster or much slower, life as we know it on Earth could not exist. We can imagine, as we close this morning, God turning to one area and to another, ticking them off according to his plan. Distance of Earth from the sun and Earth from the moon, perfect. The composition of the atmosphere, perfect. The thickness of the crust of the earth, perfect. The colour of the sun, perfect. The actual speed of light, perfect. The tilt of the earth, perfect. The rate of its rotation, perfect. The time it takes to move around the sun, perfect. What an extraordinary combination of fine-tuning at the macro and micro levels, the scientists tell us. So much so that the famous English atheist Professor Anthony Flew turned round and said, "I think that the most impressive arguments for God's existence are those that are supported by recent scientific discoveries. I think the argument from design is enormously stronger than when I first met with it." Here we find a personal God planning and wonderfully accomplishing and achieving his desires. An incredibly wise and a wonderfully kind God. We should step back and admire these things. And the more you read about them, and the more you think about it, whether it's biology, whether it's physics, whether it's chemistry, whether it's psychology, whatever it may be, or one of the more distinct parts of all of these various different subjects, whatever it is that interests you, whether it's mathematics, whether it's history, whether it's geography, whether it's anthropology, whatever it may be, it all screams out, doesn't it, in great detail, that these things could not be or have their existence without the God of the Bible. We should step back and admire the God of creation. We should enjoy his creation. God who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. We're not to hide away. We are to deny ourselves somewhat. We are to take up our cross somewhat and follow him. But Jesus enjoyed food and friends and music and art and culture and people and families and many other things that God gives us richly for our enjoyment. And we should be grateful, shouldn't we, for all of these things. For some of us, walking in the forest doesn't mean very much at all. For others, we look at all of the various different trees and the various different animals and the various different fruits and this, that and the other, and we marvel at it. For some of us, the rising of the sun over a desert or a sunset at the beach doesn't mean very much, but to others it's absolutely stunning and amazing. Looking up through a telescope or down through a microscope doesn't mean very much, and even looking around with our eyes so very often when we're young doesn't mean very much. But for some of us, we look up through a telescope, down through a microscope, don't we? And we look around with the naked eye, and what do? We respond in great gratitude to our Creator. For others, it's not the microscopes, it's not the telescopes, it's not the scientific things, it's the children playing around us, and their voices are what that delight our hearts. And we should be grateful for them. For others, it's food or various other materials that are necessary for our comfort, protection, for medicine. But nonetheless, should we not stop and admire, worship, adore, enjoy, and be grateful? This is what one day in seven is really all about, isn't it? Remembering that God, as we're going to see, created the world in 6 days and rested and set aside a seventh. And for us, even now, we have the greater joy of not just stopping and acknowledging God as our Creator and Maker, but as our Saviour and our Redeemer as well. We have an introduction to the introduction to the rest of the Bible. May God help us as we carry on next week.